Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Childhood Denied. As the lights go down on Sydney's World Youth Day, we shine the spotlight on how former child soldiers in northern Uganda are being rehabilitated after escaping from their brutal captors. A free drink in Rome. We find out more about the key role past popes played in helping to ensure a constant flow of fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of the Eternal City. This past week, the spotlight in the church has been focused on young people, with global coverage of Pope Benedict attending the World Youth Day celebrations in Sydney, Australia. Billed as the largest youth event in the world, hundreds of thousands of young pilgrims from around 170 different countries flocked to Sydney for the six-day gathering. But those young pilgrims can count themselves lucky that they were able to make the trip to Sydney, because let's not forget that around 80% of the world's youth live on less than $2 a day and could never afford such an experience or find a sponsor. And when poverty is teamed with conflict in one's home country, then the chances for a young person to attend the church's World Youth Day become even more difficult. This was the message that Ruth Townley, a young Australian Catholic who helped organise one of the exhibitions at the World Youth Day event, wanted to relay to the young pilgrims in Sydney. Ruth has just spent 2 years in northern Uganda helping to rehabilitate former child soldiers who were held captive by the Lord's Resistance Army rebels. The rebel group abducted thousands of children across northern Uganda, forcing them to either work as porters, sex slaves, or soldiers, and acquired international notoriety for the appalling brutality they used against their young captives. Ruth shared with me her harrowing yet moving experience of working with the former abductees in Uganda.
I was working up in North Uganda, which, as you probably know, has been in civil war for about 20 years. There's been peace talks going on for about 18 months, which perhaps aren't faring so well now. And over the last 2 years, the advent of World Youth Day has been an important sort of point of hope for the Catholic youth there.
I know that when you were in Uganda, you were involved in a rehabilitation program for some of these former child soldiers or sex slaves of the LRA. Can you give us some brief anecdotes of some of the most dramatic or poignant experiences that these young people have gone through?
These children were forcibly taken from their parents and they were abducted into an army and they were forced to do incredible things where conscience is denied and conscience is thwarted, which doesn't mean that their conscience doesn't exist. I remember a young woman who would probably have been about 7 when she was abducted. Often you're not entirely sure of people's ages, and was probably about 14 when she did manage to escape. And on the reunification with her father, I just remember her tears and her distress as she's apologising to her father for not having escaped prior to that, and the shame and the guilt that she felt for not escaping. And when she explained why she hadn't done it for so many years, because the other children in her cell, if they tried to escape, if recaptured, were hung by their feet from trees, and the other children in the cell, so in the unit, would be forced to take bites out of this child until the child died. And so despite knowing that she was in a terrible situation and she utterly did not want to be doing those things, the fear of experiencing that was powerful enough that she couldn't escape.
What were some of the other terrible things that she was made to do, or that were fairly typical experiences, unfortunately, for these abductees?
These experiences are very typical. So brutality becomes a way of life. You take essentially good human beings, which the vast majority of us are, and you place us in untenable situations, and the perpetrators deliver brutality, and the people who experience that become part of that brutality. And so everybody exists in this milieu of brutality and of violence.
How many of them do bear lasting psychological scars as a result of their terrible experiences?
What I have observed is that human beings are amazingly resilient creatures. We have a depth for compassion and a depth for love that is truly phenomenal in the face of absolutely horrendous experiences. The fact that North Uganda still has loving, caring communities that do their level best to look after each other is an incredible testament to our capacity to endure and to love, and that's despite the scars that they bear. Whether you were abducted or whether you were not abducted, because everybody has someone in their family who was taken into the rebels, everybody bears the scars of that. Everybody is sort of swimming in this aftermath and still trying to negotiate family and still trying to negotiate community.
And how many of these former abductees were Catholic or other Christian denominations, and how does their faith help them in overcoming the trauma of their experience with the LRA?
Faith plays a very important part in it. Faith seems to help people. We search for reasons. All of us, when we experience tragedy, we search for reasons. Why did that happen? Why should I continue to hope? Why should I try to bring children into this world? And faith enables people to keep doing that, to keep trying to forgive. Forgiveness, to give forgiveness, you can want to forgive, but you still have the nightmares. You still have the fear when you see somebody that you know did those things. You have the fear of yourself because you know that you did those things. You left people behind. People in your family died. And faith provides a support and a strength and a courage. It can help provide an answer, and it can help bring comfort to say, I don't know the reasons, but I know it's important to try and hope again tomorrow.
And talking of faith, how easy is it for these former abductees, these youngsters, to forgive their former captors?
I don't know. I know that the communities there have some very beautiful rites of forgiveness and of reconciliation, but traditionally there, the ritual of forgiveness is an ongoing process. If you do something terrible to me, I can't in one moment say, okay, I forgive you. Because forgiveness involves letting go of that chain of anger and hatred that binds me to you. And that can't happen in a moment. It takes a process where there's a long period of time where I'm very angry and I'm very, very hurt. And perhaps the perpetrator isn't in the slightest bit sorry. And so you can't have a single moment of forgiveness. It takes time. And even after the act of saying, I forgive, it still takes time after that. Forgiveness is an effortful thing. And I sometimes there's not a point where you can say forgiveness is achieved, because when the level of damage is that great, you have to do it over time.
Talking of the captors, in many cases, they were pretty young themselves. I mean, how many of them were on drugs? Was that partly what helped explain what made them indulge in such appalling brutality?
Well, appalling brutality doesn't happen in a vacuum. If a child is abducted and that child is put through a time of initiation where they are forced to do increasingly violent things, that's teaching them values, that's teaching them ways of survival, and slowly over time, they become the perpetrators of that. So it's not as simple as saying these were the captors, these were the people who did the capturing and the killing, because most of them came through that same system of violence and of hatred themselves. They were as much the victims as they were the perpetrators.
How do you go about trying to rehabilitate these youngsters? What sort of programs do you provide?
That's an interesting question. The heart of it is attempting to provide love, which is a bit of a trite answer because there's also a lot of really hard work involved in that. I was running a few programs, one of which was a youth group that used drama to explore ways of living peacefully, ways of living without alcohol, ways of living in the family and in the community without violence. And the youth were absolutely incredible. They taught me even more than I could have hoped to teach them. And we had an incident last year where two of the girls in the program were assaulted by three boys who were not part of our program. This was witnessed by some of the male youth in the group who actually gave chase, caught the juvenile offenders and held them until the adults arrived, which is a phenomenal achievement in itself because they caught the boys and they didn't beat them up. They didn't hurt them. They simply held them. And we put the girls who were assaulted and their family members and the juvenile offenders and their family members and the boys who caught the offenders and their family members through a restorative justice process where meetings, one-on-one meetings in small groups, and then eventually bringing everybody involved together over time and just continuing to talk about how we can reconcile this situation without resorting to violence. That was a very fraught and quite dangerous situation for a while. And we came out at the end of it where the offenders actually joined our program, voluntarily became part of our group, because in their words, they said, you know, it's quite something. It's quite something to not beat each other up. So the way of rehabilitating people, rehabilitating young people, is to draw on the strengths that they have.
Now, what about the parents? There's so many parents, of course, who were robbed of their children, who were abducted by these soldiers of the LRA. What's their role here, and how easy is it for the former abductees to regain a meaningful relationship with their parents? Do their parents sometimes want to reject them?
I'm thinking about one particular example of parents reuniting with their children. There was a few boys who had come out of the bush. So to come out of the bush means to leave the rebel army, which is an incredibly courageous thing to do. And I was there when this mother met with her boy, who she hadn't seen in years, and she had thought that he was dead. And it turns out he's alive, and she knows that he's done horrendous things. You could see the fear on her face, and you could see the fear in him. And you could say they danced around each other, not physically, but through the looks, through the words that they use. They recognize the other, but they're both very, very afraid. And I think it was the next morning, there was a moment she sat next to him, and he was having trouble fixing his hair. And she reached out to smooth his hair down with her fingers, and then she caught herself, and she just stopped just with her hand above his head. And she looked at him for a moment, and he just looked back at her. And then she did. She touched his hair, and she smoothed it down. Parents don't stop loving their kids.
I was speaking there to Ruth Townley about her experience of helping to rehabilitate former child soldiers in northern Uganda. The sights and sounds of flowing water are often the star attractions in many of Rome's most famous squares. In fact, the constant flow of fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of Rome has been a characteristic feature of the city since its earliest beginnings. In the torrid heat of the summer, Romans and tourists alike are grateful for the abundance of cool, refreshing water that flows from these fountains and the hundreds of simple street taps stationed throughout the city. But I wonder how many people are aware that, had it not been for the vision and generosity of a succession of past popes, today's hot and thirsty pilgrims may have found it much harder to find a ready source of refreshing water whilst exploring the Eternal City. I've been finding out more about the important role a number of past Roman pontiffs and cardinals played, both in ensuring a plentiful supply of pure water to the populace and in commissioning some of the city's most famous and beautiful fountains. Elizabeth Lev is Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University and she told me more about this almost symbiotic relationship between Rome, its popes, and water.
I think it's one of the most delightful things about Rome, the way that water is everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a water spigot or just a beautiful fountain. But that's part of Rome's history. And when the first Romans settled on those seven hills, half the reason was because it was riddled with underground springs. There would never be a lack of fresh water in the city.
And I gather that during the Roman Empire, there were no fewer than 12 aqueducts supplying water to some 1,300 fountains. That's a pretty amazing feat when you think how long ago it was and how few people there were living in the city compared to now.
As a matter of fact, the population of Rome under the empire had 1 million. Now Rome has something like 3 million, which it has to supply water to. But the water supply of Rome grew as Rome did. So Rome started out using its cisterns, underground springs, and of course the Tiber water. But by 312 BC, there wasn't enough water for the burgeoning city on the hills. So the first aqueduct was born, thanks to Appius Claudius, which brought water 10 kilometers into the city. And from then, it grew and grew and grew to end up with a colossal 12 aqueducts.
But then I gather that during the Dark Ages, all that fell into disrepair. And the city turned to using water from the Tiber.
Apparently, on page 2 or 3 of the Barbarian Siege Manual, it suggests to break the aqueducts, and the result of that was to push all the people on the hills back down towards the plain, where they could be close to the only source of water left, which was that of the Tiber.
And how long did they carry on using the water from the Tiber then?
They used it for almost 1,000 years, until the papacies of the Renaissance.
And it was Pope Sixtus IV, I gather, who reconditioned the Aqua Virgo aqueduct in the late 1400s, and that was the start, wasn't it, of another sort of golden age as far as water is concerned.
Under many senses, Sixtus IV's pontificate was a golden age. The first man to span the Tiber with a bridge, the man who built the Sistine Chapel, and the man who repristined what was known as the best of all the aqueducts, the Aqua Virgo. Because the water from that aqueduct was always known to be the purest, the cleanest, the most limpid of all.
And I gather it's still in operation today, is that
oh,
right?
Oh, yes it is. The Aqua Vergine is still working today.
But it wasn't just this pope, Pope Sixtus IV, who did all this work. I gather that the successive popes also, they created new aqueducts, they brought more water into the city, built fountains. Can you tell us something about particularly this building of the aqueduct?
Oh yes, not exactly coincidentally. The next great aqueduct-building pope will be Pope Sixtus V, who is pope from 1585 to 1590. He built his own aqueduct known as the Aqua Felice, which means the happy aqueduct. But it actually refers to his first name, which was Felice. And he brought water in from the top of the Quirinal Hill and flooded the city, really revived the construction of the city so that the city would develop back along the Quirinal Hill.
And as far as we know, what prompted them to do this? I mean, was there a religious significance behind it, or was it really just an act of papal generosity?
Water to the city historically has always been connected with generosity. The Appius Claudius who offers this aqueduct, the Marcia family which offers another aqueduct, the emperor who would build an aqueduct. But when the papacy started to rebuild and repristine these aqueducts, yes, it is, again, an act of great papal generosity. It's an act of reviving and rebuilding Rome. But I don't think you can separate this use of water, this flow of water through the city, from that sense of the call to conversion, the sense of baptism, the sense of renewal, all of these implications that water has.
What do you think was the most outstanding in terms of the engineering work concerned, or maybe just in the amount of water that it supplied, if you had to sort of look at all these projects and pinpoint one of them?
If we're talking about the ancient Rome, by the time the empire is underway, by the 2nd century AD, the aqueducts were bringing 1 million liters of water into Rome a day. It was an incredible flow of water through the city. But without the same economic resources that the imperial Rome had, without the same, even the manpower and slavery that ancient Rome had, without the same population and without the same ability to gather funds, papal Rome managed to pristine all of these aqueducts and bring back this water that would flow through the city. So it's interesting to see how the underdog, in a certain sense, which was papal Rome compared to imperial Rome, was able to recreate that great generosity of water. If it hadn't have been for these really visionary popes, they did many other things. They were concentrating on water, but these popes also had a great vision of creating out of Rome the center of the church, a place where people would come from lands and cities where there isn't much water, or where there wouldn't be bridges, or it wouldn't be so well set out and laid out as a city. And you would come to Rome and you would see through the flow of the water, through the organization of the roads, through the well-constructed city, you would see the greatness of the heart of Christendom.
Now, a lot of this water was going to feed the fountains, and of course Rome is world famous for its fountains. How instrumental was the role of the papacy here in commissioning these fountains throughout the centuries?
There are 1,500 ornamental fountains in one way or another in Rome. About 3/4 of them were built by the papacy. The popes created the particularly beautiful fountains are what is known as a show, and it's when the aqueduct first brings the water into the city. It's the moment that the water first emerges from the aqueduct and flows into its first fountain. And the shows are the ones that you know, the people know best. The Trevi Fountain is the show for the Aqua Vergine. The Moses Fountain on the top of the Quirinal Hill is the show for the Aqua Felice. And so they created these very big, beautiful fountains to celebrate the arrival of the water into the city. And then they were responsible for the cute little decorative fountains that would be in a corner of one street or tucked away into a piazza.
So let's take some of these famous fountains. The Moses Fountain, for instance, what Pope helped?
It was Sixtus V who ordered the construction of the Moses Fountain, and it's designed in the form of a triumphal arch. There are three arches, so again, the triumph of water, the arrival of water as it first emerges from the aqueduct. And the image shows Moses striking the rock for the water to leap forth, and then next to him there are these supplementary images of Aaron, the chief priest, and the people waiting for the water. And it's decorated in the front with four basalt lions, which were, at once upon a time, Egyptian lions, which are now in the Vatican Museums, but at the time they were lions that had been brought in from Egypt. And it makes a very kind of dramatic sense of triumph, which is a big part of this pontificate.
Now, of course, for most tourists, the Trevi Fountain is the most famous for a number of reasons. Can you tell us something about the papal role here?
Well, the Trevi Fountain starts as an ancient Roman aqueduct, is the show for the Aqua Vergine, which was built by the son-in-law and designated heir of Augustus, who was Agrippa in 25 BC. Now, that aqueduct, like all the others, fell into disuse, but it was legendary for the sweetness and the purity of its water. In the 1640s, Pope Urban VIII had the idea of getting people to move back onto the Quirinal Hill, moving away from the overcrowded area near the river. And he saw that Sixtus IV had already repristined the aqueduct. Water was already flowing into that area. But to create a kind of draw, he projected a very grand fountain for that show. And he started out by hiring none other than Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And Gian Lorenzo Bernini began by designing the square, not the fountain, so that the first thing that we all remember about the Trevi is the way we happened on it by surprise. I think everyone who's seen the Trevi Fountain remembers being kind of wandering through streets, wondering where this fountain is, and then the shock and surprise of encountering the fountain. And that was the work of Bernini. Now, the project then lay unattended to for almost 100 years. And it was just let go because it was too expensive, because it was too complicated, because there wasn't much interest. But between 1730 and 1740, the Corsini Pope decided to call up a contest to see who could come up with the best design. And Niccolò Salvi won the contest for designing the Trevi Fountain. Poor Niccolò Salvi didn't even live to see his fountain completed. It wasn't done until Benedict XIV's reign in 1762.
And Piazza Navona, of course, the Four Rivers fountain there. Is there a papal link to this as well?
Well, that fountain is one of the most famous papal fountains of all. That fountain is, for art historians, it's the fountain that got Bernini back into papal graces, because there had been a big blow-up between Pope Innocent X and the artist Bernini in 1644, basically. Over the facade of St. Peter's, they were constructing a bell tower, and Bernini was in charge of the construction, and a crack formed in the facade of St. Peter's, and Innocent X, of course, was infuriated. There were a number of Bernini detractors who were ready to whisper in the ear of Innocent X, and Bernini had been sent away in disgrace from papal court. Now, in 1650, Innocent X wanted to build a fountain for what was essentially his front yard. The Pamphili Palace is the palace on the Piazza Navona that looks out over the Four Rivers Fountain. And he wanted a fountain that would combine an obelisk with this ancient Egyptian monument that were beginning to pop up all over the city. But at the same time, he wanted to bring water to the piazza out of that same generous appearance of the papacy. But everybody who presented projects to him presented the same thing, sort of an obelisk, a trough, the water. It wasn't very exciting. And the Pope was dissatisfied. Well, Bernini made a sterling silver model of the fountain that you see today, and he had it left in the Pope's apartments. And when the Pope came in and saw that model of the fountain, he said, "This is my fountain. This is the one. Who made it?" And when he heard that the artist was Bernini, he said, "Those who would not use the works of Bernini had better not look at them." And so Bernini was back in papal graces and constructing that wonderful fountain of the Four Rivers.
I was speaking there to Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture. And that's all from the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.